brings.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation here to this wonderful conference. I'm very happy to be here. The title of my talk is F&D terms from the seven brains, and the question which I'm interested in is, can one have from a microscopic description, namely from type 2B orientifolds with the seven brains, can one generate F terms, in particular from non-perturbative superpotentials like a genome condensation or D3 instantons, and D terms which are necessary for the uplift of an anti-de Sitter vacuum at the same time. This seems to be a little bit problematic a priori by reasons which I will explain, but I think I will also offer a solution where you can have both F and D terms simultaneously. So the work which I'm presenting is in collaboration with people from Munich, with Susanne Reffert, Emanuel Scheidegger, he is in Vienna actually, Waldemar Schuldin, another PhD student, and Stefan Stieberger. And well, this was an extended research, and fortunately I can now communicate that the two papers will be out next week, so we are very happy about it. It was really an extended work, and 100 respectively 70 pages long, so you can see a lot of work went into that. And then I will also talk about an ongoing work with Michael Haag, who is here, Daniel Krefer, student in Munich, Juan van Prooy and Marco Zagemann, in particular about this aspect, how to make compatible the F and D terms. So I think I do not have to make a very big introduction, because many speakers explained various general ideas about string compactification and string landscape ideas, so I can go right away to some specific framework. Namely, I like to consider type 2B orientifold compactifications on background spaces which are given by Flatt-Minkowski space-time times some compact Calabi-Yau space Y, which is divided by some orientifold projection, which then leads to O3 and O7 planes. And I think this scenario is, say, T-dual to intersecting the six brains in type 2A, and possibly other setups which have O5 and O9 planes, which were discussed here already. As you know, these models offer several phenomenologically attractive features. Namely, one can build at least semi-realistic models for particle physics, kind of MSSM-like realizations from open strings which live on the seven brains. The scenario is particularly suited, and therefore I think it's useful to discuss this in the type 2B language. It's particularly suited for modelized stabilization from three-form fluxes and non-perturbative effects on the seven brains. In particular, there is this, I think, very interesting and very promising KKT scenario, where there's also the possibility of obtaining the Sitter vacuum with a positive cosmological constant. And moreover, possibly, I think these models are also interesting from the cosmological point of view, if you include other space-time filling D3 brains, which runs under the name of D3, D7 inflation, but this is some aspect which I do not want to discuss here any further. So let me just give a very close overview how we imagine intersecting D-brain model building. Namely, we start with a local D-brain module which realizes the standard model locally. And in the simplest case, it is given by four stacks of intersecting D-brains. So this was discussed by many other speakers, by Miriam, also by Hermann Verlinde. So this is, should be a stack of D7 brains which realizes the standard model, and the particular, the standard model degrees of freedom, the quarks and the leptons are given as open strings which sit at the intersection of the D-brains. And then if we further go on and study more concrete compactifications, we have to wrap these modules, these D-brains, around cycles of the compact background space. So here it is, we choose some Calabi-Yau space. And let us assume that at one corner of the Calabi-Yau space, there are four cycles around which the D7 brains are wrapped, which gives rise then to the standard model. So here we have the standard model module located. And in fact, it should be precisely those setup which is here realized locally, giving rise to the standard model gauge group. Moreover, in general, we have a hidden sector module, and this hidden sector module then is responsible for moduli stabilizations by methods which we will discuss. And moreover, there will be also an interplay, a messenger fields between the hidden sector module and the standard model module by gravity or by gauge mediation, which in particular then triggers soft Suzy braking parameters. So let us enter the moduli stabilization program by KKLT. And one can divide it in two steps, essentially. The first step is characterized by F terms, namely we fix all moduli, first preserving supersymmetry, including the dilaton, the complex structure moduli U, which are stabilized by three-form fluxes, and also the Keller moduli, which are stabilized non-perturbative effects on D3 and D7 brains. And still preserving supersymmetry, one generically ends up in an ADS vacuum. And to remind you, the non-perturbative superpotential generically has this form. It is given by an exponential of the Keller modulus T. And in general, there will be also a prefactor here, which depends on other moduli and complex structure moduli, on open string moduli, and also on the dilaton in general. In the second step, then we are trying to lift this ADS minimum of the potential to a metastable de Sitter vacuum. And this can be done in several ways. At least there are several proposals. The first proposal of the original KKLT paper is to introduce D3 bar brains. And in this case, the potential is inverse proportional to the radius or to the Keller modulus T, which appears also in this non-perturbative superpotential. A second proposal is to include the seven with open string gauge flux, F flux. And this will then, as we will see, and as it was also already discussed by various authors, as it was discussed in the original paper by Burgess, Kalosh, and Quevedo, this should then introduce a D-term potential which is very similar to the potential which originates from anti-D3 brains. So in both cases, I think the uplift works if we succeed to have a non-perturbative superpotential which depends on Keller modulus, and at the same time, the uplift potential should depend on the same type, on the same kind of modulus. In this case, the uplift eventually has a chance to work. And to remind you how the picture looks like, first we have this anti-de Sitter minimum here. After the uplift, it is raised to a minimum, to a metastable minimum with a small, it's almost not visible here, small cosmological constant. And by phonological reasons, one has to tune fluxes in such a way that the height of this minimum is of the order of the gravitino mass. So there's some fine tuning involved here, which can be done by properly choosing three-form fluxes. So my talk will now address two questions. Namely, the first question is, can all moduli be fixed in an anti-de Sitter vacuum by F terms from D3 and D7 brains in some specific models? And the models we want to consider are blown up orbifold models. This is a work which appears right now. And since I have talked about this already at strings in Beijing, I will only give the main results here at this conference. The second question then is, can D-terms be obtained from also microscopically by D7 brains? Namely, it is possible to have a D-term uplift using D7 brains, or is there possibly a clash between the F and the D-terms? And there is a lot of related work, in particular by Jokas Lewis. Fabio talked about it. I also like to draw your attention on the nice paper by Achukaro, and also the work by Hans-Peter Nilles and collaborators. So let us start quickly with the F terms. We assume that there is a non-perturbative superpotential which can have two origins, namely first by Euclidean D3 brains which are wrapped on some four cycles C4 inside the Calabi-Yau space, and the four cycle volume is denoted by the corresponding Keller modulus Tj. In this case, we get a superpotential of this form. However, there are very stringent non-trivial conditions for the emergence of such a non-vanishing superpotential, namely essentially the so-called arithmetic genus chi, which depends on the Hodge numbers of the four cycle, has to be 1. However, this is a quite subtle issue because this topological number also depends on the three-form flux and also depends on the O7 plane, so one really has to investigate this in detail. The second mechanism is Gaugino condensation in the effective gauge theory, which lives on the D7 brains, and again we assume that the D7 brains, which are space-time filling, are therefore wrapped on specific four cycles. And like here, there are kind of topological conditions for non-vanishing Gaugino condensation superpotential that essentially we cannot allow for massless adjoint multiplets, which means open string moduli on the D7 brains, because this would render the beta function positive and Gaugino condensation in the effective field theory would not be possible. Let me comment also on the prefactor of the non-perturbative superpotential, in particular when we deal with Gaugino condensation. One origin of the prefactor generically is the gauge kinetic function has more than this three-level contributions, namely in type 2B models and in other models there are loop corrections which depend on the complex structure fields and also on the dilatons, and one can make for classes of models specific computations, and you get like in heteroptic models that this prefactor is given by a Dedekind function in terms of the U model. There could be additional instantons in the D7 brain gauge theory, and there can be also contributions by charged matter fields, and this is the issue which I will discuss in the next section. So we have to wait a little bit to see how these charged matter fields eventually contribute to the non-perturbative superpotential. So if you put this all together, we have the three-level piece of the type 2B orientifold superpotential given by fluxes, the non-perturbative piece, again summarized here. Maybe I should draw your attention, there's a little subtlety, because the number of Kähler moduli is restricted by the even part of the H11 homology which survives under the orientifold projection. So not in general, not all Kähler moduli appear in this non-perturbative superpotential. So there are remaining moduli which have to be fixed by different mechanisms, which I will comment quickly later on. There's a Kähler potential of this form. Using these two ingredients, we can, using standard supergravity formula, compute the F-term scalar potential is given by this equation, imposing the supersymmetry constraints, namely that the F-terms, namely the Kähler covariant derivatives, are zero. We will be able to fix eventual all moduli, and as a generic result is that all known Susi-Vakia with all moduli fixed are anti-de-Sitter type. Okay, so the question we pose now in our work is, this is a kind of general scenario, and the question is whether this scenario can be really concretely realized in a class of models. And the class of models we were considering are smooth Calabi-Yau spaces, which are obtained by blowing up singularities, orbifold singularities of these abelian well-known orbifold models. So studying this question, geometrical knowledge is necessary. In particular, toric geometry turns out to be very useful. I will not describe this all the steps now in detail. It is summarized here what you have to do. First, you go to local patches, and you can describe the blow-up or the resolution of the singularities by toric methods. Then you have to glue all this together to get a smooth, compact Calabi-Yau space. You have to form fault projection. Then there comes this issue of the divisor topologies I have told you, to see whether really all divisors contribute to the non-perturbative superpotential. One has to compute the Kähler potential, by computing the triple intersection numbers. Then we fix the dilaton and the complex structure modeler by three-form fluxes. We look for the critical point of the scalar potential. And I like to draw your attention that there's also another criteria which we implied and other people also discussed, namely, in order to be prepared for stable uplift, we require that already in the anti de Sitter vacuum, all masses of the moduli, all mass squares of the moduli are positive, because this feature, the mass matrix, the texture of the mass matrix of the moduli normally survives the uplift. In order then to have a stable de Sitter vacuum, we apply this restriction. So the results are the following. That in fact, not in every model, all divisors have the correct topology to contribute to the non-perturbative superpotential. There's a kind of no-go theorem for models which no complex structure moduli, namely that this last criterion cannot be satisfied, that a stable uplift to a de Sitter vacuum is therefore not possible for this kind of models. Then there is this comment on models which possess odd cohomology under the orientifold projection. Here the F terms cannot fix all moduli, however the additional moduli can be fixed by additional D terms, which I do not show here, it's discussed in our paper. So the conclusion is that still moduli stabilization in type 2B orientifolds is model dependent. However, in particular examples, like in these moduli, like in these models, all moduli can be fixed, and I think this is a rather non-trivial result, because some of these models contain a rather huge number of Keller moduli of the order of 60 or 70, and one can really demonstrate that they can all be fixed. I maybe should not forget that there was the 2 times the 2 example here, which was first discussed by Denev, Shamit, and others, and they also, of course, show that in this model, all moduli really can be fixed to an anti-de Sitter vacuum. So after discussing the F terms, let us now proceed to the D terms. And in general, as you know, a D term potential arises from the existence of a gauged shift symmetry. So let us consider a U1 gauge group, which I call U1F by some reasons which will come clear, I think, later. So we consider U1F gauge transformations, which eventually will be anomalous. So the U1F vector superfield VF transforms under U1 gauge transformations in this well-known way where lambda is the gauge parameter. Now we also want to assume that this vector superfield mixes in the Keller potential. It's a chiral superfield, which by some reasons I call T with the subscript C, so TC. So for simplicity, we will assume this kind of a Keller potential, where the mixing between the chiral superfield T and the vector superfield is given by a parameter which we call delta GS for Green-Schwarz. So you see, hence, to keep the Keller potential invariant, also TC has to shift under this U1 symmetry in the following way, namely simply has to shift by I times delta GS times lambda, which means in particular the imaginary part, the axion, has to shift under the symmetry, and therefore there is this well-known mixing term in the effective Lagrangian that means that AC appears with the gauge covariant derivative of this form in the effective Lagrangian if you compute the kinetic term from this Keller potential. So I guess this is well known. Further on, I think it is also well known that this mixing between AC and the gauge field of U1F leads to the following Fallier-Iopoulos D-term potential. Namely, this D-term potential is just given by the square of the Fallier-Iopoulos parameter xi. The xi essentially is given by the derivative of the Keller potential with respect to the vector superfield, where we set the vector superfield equal to zero. So in this simple example, you could equally well make the derivation with respect to the chiral superfield T, and you will essentially get the same result. So after this simple computation, we see that the D-term potential is proportional to our delta GS parameter square times 1 over TC square, the real part of TC square. In fact, this D-term potential arises from the standard expression if you make the following identification, namely we know that it is proportional to the square of the D-term, and the D-term is given in general by the derivative of the Kähler potential times the so-called Killing vector, which in this case is constant and is related to the gauge shift symmetry. Now, now we come to the important issues. One realizes that there can be two non-gauge invariants in the effective action. Namely, we want to assume that in addition there is another gauge group called GC being built out of a product of a U1 factor and SRN factor, which gauge with a field-dependent gauge coupling, which we call a real part of TC. And then it is clear that first this term in the effective action is not U1F invariant, because we have already obtained that TC has to shift under the gauge symmetry. So this term is obviously not invariant. Furthermore, if the beta function of SUN is such that SUNC induces a Gaugino condensate, then apparently also the non-perturbative superpotential of this form is also not gauge invariant, because TC shifts here in the exponent. And this is the apparent clash which I have mentioned at the beginning between the non-perturbative superpotential and the appearance of the D-terms, which we want to cure, which we want to remedy. And yes, Fabio is, of course, ahead of my talk, and also, in addition, very clever. So it is obvious what will happen. The prefactor also will transform under the gauge symmetry, and how it arises, I will explain, you know, how it arises microscopically from D7 brains, I will explain to you now. So both invariances can be cancelled by the same mechanism if we assume furthermore that there are also NF metafields present, and these metafields first should have a charge under the U1 gauge symmetry, and they also should be in some, in the simplest case, fundamental representations of the gauge group S. Then the first non-invariance is cancelled because now the U1F symmetry becomes anomalous because of this triangle diagram. This is a well-known Greig-Schwarz mechanism, and hence the invariance 1 is cancelled. But my emphasis is more on the second non-invariance of the related to the superpotential. And as it was already stated, due to the metafields, the non-perturbative Dein, Affleck, Seiberg type or Witten type of superpotential gets a prefactor, where this prefactor is given by the determinant of these metafields, where we assume that the number of metafields is smaller than the number of colors. So now the non-perturbative superpotential is also U1 invariant if by some reason the mixing term, the delta Green-Schwarz term, is just proportional to the number of metafields we have introduced. So this is a non-trivial restriction, which is a priori not obvious why delta Green-Schwarz should be just given by the family number, by the number of metafields. The reason is because the phi fields always transform with a constant. They have just charge 1 under the U1 gauge transformation. And moreover, the D-term potential will be also get a contribution by these metafields in this way. Okay, so in the last 3 or 4 minutes, I want to discuss very quickly how we can derive this D-term potential microscopically in type 2 orientifolds with D7 brains. And the essential ingredient is that we have to put F-flux on the one type of the D7 brain. So the setup we like to consider is the following. We like to consider two kinds or stacks of D7 brains. One stack we call D7F, and possibly we can have a full stack, namely little nf of them. They carry world volume 2-form flux. They are wrapped around a divisor, which I call sigma, and they contain in particular the anomalous U1F gauge group. Secondly, we introduce another stack called D7C, and this is a stack which is then responsible for the Gaugino condensation, so it contains the confining gauge group SUNC. And most importantly, we assume that these two stacks intersect each other, that they are bifundamental metafields of this form, so they transform under the fundamental representation under this gauge group. They carry U1 charge equal to 1. And their number is given by a topological intersection number, essentially, which you call Q alpha sigma. And the aim is to show that this Q alpha sigma is precisely proportional to the mixing parameter delta green Schwarz, because in this case, the superpotential is invariant. So my time is running, so I cannot show you all the details. The method to derive the determined potential, I think Fabio used the same method, is to use the so-called Dirac-Born infeld action for the seven brains with efflux. There's a so-called BPS calibration condition on the cycle sigma around which this D7 brain is wrapped. So we use our space-time ansatz from before, and then one can factor out a special expression which we call gamma sigma from this Dirac-Born infeld action. And if you now do a low-energy expansion, we can derive from the Born infeld action first, the potential of the D7 brains, which is proportional to gamma sigma, and also the gauge coupling. So both the potential and the gauge coupling are proportional to the same term, to the same factor, gamma sigma. So now we eventually want to relate this to the elements of the Calabi-Yau geometry and topology. So first, in the standard way, we introduce the Kähler form J for the ambient Calabi-Yau, which is given by the volumes V alpha of the geometrical four cycles. We compute the Calabi-Yau volume by introducing the triple intersection numbers K. And we also have to introduce the cohomology of the divisor sigma. And here, this is some, I think, relevant detail. There are two type of 1-1 forms. First, the pullbacks from the ambient Calabi-Yau, but also another 1-1 forms which live only locally on the divisor, which means that they live in the co-kernel of this map. And using this, one can expand the two-form gauge fields in this way. So we use the calibration condition to express the real part of gamma sigma, and I have introduced the redefined gamma, this is not so important, and the imaginary part of gamma sigma by these topological numbers of the Calabi-Yau space. And I'd like to draw your attention that in the imaginary part, quantity Q appears, which is essentially given by the product of the intersection numbers times the two-form flux. And this Q is nothing else than the intersection number, the chiral intersection number between the two stacks of brains. So you see already at this point that the number of families which contribute to the Gugino condensate is given by little n f times this topological number Q. So after doing several other things, namely expanding our expressions for small imaginary part of gamma, some point which was also explained by Fabio, we will get eventually the potential for the D7 brains, in this case already the determined potential proportional to imaginary square of gamma, and the gauge coupling constant, which is given by this expression, which also contains the intersection numbers and the fluxes. Finally, in the last step, one has to perform a field redefinition from the four cycles given in the geometrical string basis to the supergravity fields. I think some people call this a row problem, but in fact it is not a problem, because one knows how this field redefinition, which is written down here, has to be performed. And after doing this field definition, you get very nice and handy expressions for the gauge couplings in terms of the supergravity variables, in particular for the deep term potential. And as promised, you see now that the coupling term, the Fayer-Yiopoulos parameter, is indeed proportional to this intersection number Q. So what I have called before delta green Schwarz is given by an F times Q, and this is indeed of the familiar form of the supergravity with a gauge U1 symmetry. And now it is only a little homework for you that indeed the superpotential, including the metafields, is invariant under the shift symmetry. So I summarize and give a few more remarks. We have shown that wrapped D7 brains can produce coexisting F and D terms. The essential ingredient is the anomalous U1F symmetry, gauge symmetry, which results that the superpotential depends in this well-known way on the metafields, and the metafields also enter the D-term potential in this way. The important part is that the intersection number between these two stacks is non-vanishing, which means that only axionic four cycles that intersect sigma can be charged under the gauged U1, and moreover, if sigma has safe intersection, then the volume of T sigma itself will be charged. One can construct, in fact, a little toy model, which we will present in the paper. However, there's also a caveat, because now if you minimize the whole thing, the metafields must be also taken into account. And there is a danger that having non-zero vacuum expectation values, the D-term eventually can vanish. So one has to ensure that the D-term indeed is non-zero. So we can also think about generalizations, namely there's a limiting case where NF is equal to NC, which is a little bit tricky. We could also extend the analysis to orient defaults which have symmetric and anti-symmetric representation under the confining gauge group, or go to orient defaults which have SO or SP gauge symmetries. So I'd like to thank you for your attention.
You have chosen a very simple configuration with a single anomalous U1 for obvious purposes, of course, to show the point. And this made the determination of the superpotential rather easy by using already an existing result. In the general case, we know we have several anomalous U1s and they interact non-trivially. Is it obvious if there is some simple way of writing down the superpotential without any real dynamical information in the general case?
Yes, I think you're of course very right. For pedagogical reasons, I have chosen this simple example. However, as I have shown you already, the superpotential in general not only depends on one T-field, but on several T-fields. So one has to ensure that each term, the superpotential, is invariant under the relative shift symmetries. I think if in case there are metafields between the U1 stack of the seven brains and the stack of the seven brains which appear in the superpotential, then the mechanism will work out in the way I have shown to you. But I think certainly one has to work out the details where you not only have one but several of those anomalous U1s. But I think it should work out, because eventually, as you know, if you really have a microscopic string description, all the symmetries of the effective field theory which must be obeyed are eventually obeyed. So there will be no clash. And this is just to show it in an explicit construction.
Yeah, I have a question. In the original paper that we wrote with Kalish and Linda Introvetti, one of the reasons that we wanted to use an anti-brain in this complicated warp setup was simply to get an exponentially small contribution that breaks supersymmetry, so that after the F and D terms rebalance themselves, there's some natural sense in which you have low energy supersymmetry. So as far as I can tell now, your D terms are naturally of order one. That is, all the charges there are of order one. So is it really true that you'll get vacua with very low energy in some parametric way, or will the Susie breaking scale when you find vacua be quite large?
I agree with you. This is a potential problem which we did not study in full detail. I can first refer to this paper by Achukawa et al., where some attempts were made to minimize this type of potentials. Also, these authors have not given this microscopic underlying string derivation. On the other hand, I think maybe one can also use the framework of large volume compactification, where your arguments do not apply in this way, because then the superpotential must not be tuned, but it can be of order one, and then the uplift also must not be tuned in this way. So maybe the scenario of large volume is more suitable for this kind of D-term considerations.
So a quick comment and then a quick question. Regarding the rho problem, there may be several aspects of that, but one is the dependence of the holomorphic moduli on positions of mobile D3 brains, and I'm not sure that what you were saying in your redefinition really addresses that.
No, certainly not, because I haven't included open string moduli by D3 brains. But for example, if you go to F theory or other models, I think eventually all these field theory definitions can be worked out explicitly, at least in principle. And it's not only that you have to stare at some exponent of some holomorphic superpotential saying This has to be your holomorphic modulus. I think there are also other methods, namely deriving the proper Kähler potential and other things, and the proper gauge coupling constant, of course, to see what are the holomorphic variables. So in this case, there is no rho problem because we know how the field redefinition from the Calabi-Yau geometrical moduli to the type 2B Orion default moduli works. So here there is no rho problem.
Okay. And then the question is, with the models with no complex structure moduli, what is the origin of this no-go result? Could you say a few
yes,
more words about that?
One can prove for general Kähler potentials that models which have no complex structure moduli, so only an S field which is stabilized by the three-form fluxes, the mass matrix between the Kähler moduli and the axion of the S field also always is negative definite. So in this sense, the uplift is not possible. Of course, this is not against stability for ADS because there is this Brayton-Lohner-Friedmann bound and all the masses satisfy the Brayton-Lohner-Friedmann bound. So the ADS vacua by supersymmetry are certainly stable. But if you want to uplift in this way, at least this is a good argument, I think, then the theorem applies. And then it is for sure that models with no complex structure moduli cannot be uplifted, or cannot, for them, the KKAT doesn't work.
I have a comment related to Shami's question and now to Steve's also. We have been working on this also for a while, and we have started doing the similar thing that you have done with the magnetized D7s and a singlet under the non-abelian group. And so we can see if the D-term uplifting works. And the more concrete way to do it is in the large volume scenario that we have under control in that regard. And we managed to get the uplifting, but it works whenever the modulus is the size of the fourth cycle that is large, the exponentially large fourth cycle. If it is one of the other ones, we still it's not clear if it is going to work or not. And then this makes the question of Shami more relevant, because it's precisely for the large volume where you have where you can neglect the warping effects. So and you need the warping in even in large volume. You need the warping to do the uplifting in a smooth way. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you can get rid of the problem by going to the large volume. And no.
Mm. I don't know whether I understood you correctly. Mm-hmm. There's this case where you have safe intersections, then it will be the one and the same modulus which is charged and which appears and is given by the gauge coupling constant of the anomalous U1, but I don't know
yes.
whether...
No, I agree with you. The thing is that what simplifies lives in the exponential large volume case is that this field that couples to in the non-perturbative potential, that is irrelevant because it's the exponential of an exponential small thing. So then you can neglect essentially the non-perturbative effects and still get the thing to work. And but still, you get the sitter, so you get a positive contribution to the potential, but the coefficient has to be, you have to argue that has to be still very small, as Shami is saying, and that's the difficult thing to get.
Right. I mean, so far we did not think so much about all these aspects of, say, phenomenology. We wanted to explore the mechanism, how we can get both...
Yeah, but it's this is the relevant part. I think that you need to get the lift, and so you need to be able to do
I
it in a smooth way.
It's also very important for us to sort out or to see how or whether you can realize this by a microscopic deep brain construction.
Well, we had it already.
So, last quick question.
Just a quick technical question. I mean, when you introduce your dependence in the determinant, aren't you then somehow eliminating the T from W, which originally was the one that governed Gaussian quantization? So that I'm worried that you get a runaway then in the direction of this T, because you are by holomorphicity, this T will not anymore be at the minimum from which KKLT start.
No, I don't think so, because you have also the W0, which comes from fluxes, and I think the stabilization for the T should not be changed in a dramatic way. I know, but it didn't depend on T in the original KKLT scenario either.
So we thank the speaker again.